This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
With a strong language warning.
And Virginia Trioli.
Woo-hoo! You're too kind. Thank you very much. Good evening. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Wheeler Centre for this very special In Conversation with a woman who is fully clad.
Unexpectedly.
And I will say that I'm a little disappointed.
I'm sorry about that. I'll come naked next time.
We'll get to the disappointment about nakedness a little later in the conversation. We're here because Tracy is a clever woman, a funny woman, a brave woman, and has written a very, very lovely memoir, which will be on sale at the end of our discussion in the corner back there, and Tracy will be signing books, so I urge you to get one. It is called The Good Girl Stripped Bare. She did do a little bit of a striptease along the way, and as I said, we will get to that. But we're going to start, I think, Tracy, at the beginning, and first of all, good evening.
Good evening, and thank you so much for being in conversation with me tonight. You've
Pleasure.
Been one of my role models for a long time, and I know you've got to get up at 2:30 in the morning, so let's get cracking.
She's not even joking. The alarm does go off at 2:30. I'm delighted to be here because I love the book, and the subject is, well, it's the story of our lives, isn't it? It's the story that we've lived, and we can spend some time talking about that too. We're going to speak up here for about 40 minutes and then we're going to have, a special little interlude, actually, and we'll get to that as well, and then we'll take your questions, and then Tracy will be up the back signing books for you as well. But I learnt a weird new word reading your book, and that word was Bevan. What's a Bevan?
A Bevan is the Queensland word for bogan. I grew up in Queensland. My father's middle name is Bevan, so the blood of the Bevan runs through my veins. And I brought that up because this book is not only about gender, it's also about class, about the working class and the structural challenges in society and the workplace that women and people of lower socioeconomic class areas confront. I grew up in a very, very rough area on the outskirts of Brisbane, and I learnt early that women really had to struggle to be valued and respected in society and to be really to be considered full human beings rather than as a wife or a mother or a daughter, an appendage to somebody else.
I was wondering when I read your book, and particularly the early parts of it, your origin story, the place you come from and its culture, it's really significant for you and in your story, isn't it? Why is that?
It is, and a friend of mine described the book as a bit of a bait and switch. It starts out like puberty blues and then it ends up being quite a feminist rant and a call to action for nasty women to join together towards the end and join the revolution. I think it's important because you learn your values in an area like that, but you also learn the struggles that, you know, people who live in poverty face, but also that women face, and the kind of challenges with trying to break out of that.
Yeah. And you mentioned class, and class really is an important subtext in that book as well. And I'm wondering if somehow that's central to or part of the imposter syndrome that you refer to often in your book as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think it's part of it. What I noticed working in the media for 30 years, like working in a lot of society's institutions in corporate Australia, is that it's full of people from private schools who've had privileged lives. Mm. And what I learned when I saw Yarn Event on the television, I don't think I just wanted to be a current affairs host or a journalist. I think I wanted to be a slight dark-haired woman of Eastern European origin because she seems so much more sophisticated than being the Bevan chick from Redcliffe. And what I saw growing up, because I had a father who was very passionate about social justice and a mother who was very passionate about equality, was that institutions crush us. You know, corporations crush us. There's the commercial pressures in society. And it's very hard to break out of that strata of society.
Your mother, you mentioned your mother and your father there in passing, and your mother is was and I'm sure continues to be a huge influence in your life. Why was she so important to you?
She was so important because from when my sister and I were little, she brought us up to believe that we could do anything. But she was realistic with that as well. She said, you don't have to have children. The world is your oyster. Go out and seek a career.
That's unusual for I guess, a mother from that place and at that time to actually directly say, you don't have to have children, particularly when her experience of having children and a family clearly was so happy for her.
It's a great point. It's incredibly unusual. She ran away from home at 17 because her father came back from the war with shell shock. She made money the only way she could, by using her beauty as currency. She worked as a model. And, you know, she didn't like doing it, but that's what she had to do to make ends meet. And when my sister and I were very small, you know, she took us aside and said, you don't have to work the way that I worked. You can go to university. You can use your brains instead of your beauty. And that message really stuck with me, that whole women only being valued for their appearance, Naomi Wolf and the beauty myth. So really, it was a gift for life. Mum, incidentally, was the first female courier driver in Queensland. She had a whole bunch of jobs to make ends meet. And the newspaper up in Queensland reported on this remarkable feat with the line, who would have thought? Women can drive after all.
It's amazing. But notwithstanding her admonition to you and her warning about, you know, what you didn't have to do, the beauty thing did actually start early in your life, didn't it?
It absolutely did. You notice, and that's why I called it the good girl stripped bare, from when you're very young, I find, as a woman, that you're complimented on your beauty more than your intellect or your ability. It's always about how you look and what you wear. Mum actually sent me off to a deportment course at June Daly Watkins, to my abject horror, as I stood there watching people measuring young women around the waist and complimenting them on their 18-inch waists. And, you know, then looking at me and telling me I should go on an egg and grapefruit diet. So I think
that
a lot of
that would make you such good company, an egg and grapefruit diet. Wouldn't you like to be with her at the end of the day?
Yes, that's right. The smell, not so good. But and I think that's why, you know, we see these images around us in society and in the mass media, and inevitably they seep into our psyche. Mm. And it builds up, like the old 1950s expression, putting on a face before leaving the house. Over a lifetime, we build up this mask before we feel we can confront proper society.
And yet there you are trying out for Miss Australia.
I know. I'm still so embarrassed about that. It was when I was at university in the Bjocke-Peterson era, and we had some fabulous lefty lecturers, and on weekends we were marching, you know, for our rights and all of this kind of stuff. The brown shirts, the secret police were filming us for files that we only found a couple of years ago. But on the side, I still felt like I wanted to live up to my mother's role modelling with, you know, her being a beautiful woman, even though she was also a strong woman. That's what I mean by these things seep into our psyche. So some very embarrassing photos in the book that I'm very ashamed of me with a poodle perm and one of those really full-on aqua taffeta dresses with a sash across me. I felt like Honey Boo Boo upsized.
She looks beautiful.
I look horrific, thank you.
She really does. But the body awareness, you know, the overwhelming interest that you mentioned in how we look and the double standards around that, it seems to me that, it seems in the book that that never really left you, or is that hindsight? Or was it there at the time as well?
I think it built up because I did go into television when I was relatively young.
Yes.
I was 22 when I had my first job in country television. And from that moment, the criticism came. When I went to university and worked in radio, it was all about what you could do. I worked at 3AW down here, tremendous training ground. Then I went out to country TV in Traralgon. And one of the first things I heard was a comment over the intercom system between all the regional stations with someone saying, oh, how's that chubby girl from Queensland going? And I thought, oh, there's a new girl here and she's from Queensland as well. Maybe we'll be friends. And then I thought, shit, I am the chubby girl from Queensland. And it just hadn't occurred to me that television was that, you know, full on about how a young woman should look. Oh, then there was the other anecdote about at the end of my year in country television, my boss said, I said, do you think I'll make it in the city like my heroine yarn event? Oh, you'll never make it in the city, Trace. Oh, why? Because you're a blonde and people think blondes are stupid. So I learnt very early in television that appearance was everything.
Extraordinary thing. Well, I mean, we don't need to comment on how extraordinary that is, but also just such a blatant contradiction of themselves because they just kept hiring blondes to put on TV anyway. Were they aware of their own, you know, sort of stupidity here and in internal contradictions?
Possibly not. But again, it was that, and many feminist writers have written about this, Tara Moss most recently, that you may be beautiful and you may be intelligent, but you may not be both. That is not possible. I mean, does anyone do you ever hear people talking about a handsome bloke and saying it's remarkable, he's incredibly intelligent as well?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I remember when I walked onto the editorial floor of The Age for my, you know, first real job in journalism, and I started as a cadet, and I, you know, walked onto the third floor of the Spencer Street building of The Age, this awful room of olive green carpet and burnt orange Laminex desks. And there was this extraordinary hive of activity around me, and someone, you know, dashing across the room holding a photograph, and someone else on the phone, you know, pressuring a contact for information, and someone over there yelling at someone else. And I walked in and I just thought, I found home. I absolutely belong here. What did you feel when you first arrived in journalism? Was it something similar?
It was exactly that. And I think the thing I'm most proud of from that era is a documentary I did in country television about the plague of white asbestos at the Loy Yang power station, and the fact it was killing workers there to the point where they were working on lathes and building up enough asbestos around their chins that they looked like Santa, and they'd all go ho, ho, ho and laugh at each other as their children and wives came in to visit. And it was only in, I think it was 2003, that asbestos was finally banned in Victoria because of the media and union campaign. And I feel exactly this. Look, I feel exactly the same way in newsrooms now. I feel I want to tell stories, I want to interview people, and it's just such a bloody shame that there's this layer of misogyny over the top of that.
So were you immediately aware of being in such a male culture and of what that meant and of the threats and dangers that that posed?
Definitely. And the threats and dangers are quite physical. I mean, when I started working at Channel 9 down here under a news director called John Sorrell, he was yelling at people across the newsroom, I want 2 inches off your hair and 2 inches off your ass. So many women quit because of the physical bullying. He held one of my colleagues out the window three floors up and said, if you make another mistake, I'm dropping you out this fucking window. So when we're talking about dangers, it's more than just a robust workplace culture. It's constant bullying and harassment.
So when you're aware of this, and I think it's different perhaps for various women as they go through this journalism system. Some are immediately aware and hyper aware of that environment and have to make careful choices as a result. I think others, you know, gradually become aware of it, usually through missteps and problems they encounter. But then you've got to figure out, it seems to me, a way to negotiate this minefield. How to be taken seriously without selling out other women, for example. How to get on without turning yourself into a bloke as well. How did you negotiate all of that?
Chris Barth said to me recently, you either become a pretty princess or you become one of the boys.
And is there no middle course?
I think there is a middle course now of being, you know, assertive and being a good journalist and standing up for yourself, but not many very young women are confident enough to do that.
Yeah.
And so I fell into the default of being the good girl, of trying to please everybody. If this is the system, then I will try to fit into it as best I can.
Mm. And did that work for you up to a point?
Look, it's a really good question. I think it did short term, but I hated it. And I hated myself for it. I certainly never flirted or became the pretty princess because I'm about as flirtatious as a brick. It's just not my thing. I don't get it. I don't understand it. I think it's repulsive in a workplace. But I was the good girl. I was diligent. I worked very hard. I said yes. I became the yes girl. Yes, I'll work those long hours. Yes, I'll do those shifts. No, I will never ask for a pay rise. So I became the compliant employee.
Yeah, look, the good girl that you described, particularly in relation to wages and salary, is really interesting in this book, because it seems that there's myriad opportunities for you to simply improve your paycheck, and yet you turn them down again and again. What did you think would happen if you raised your voice or raised your hand?
I thought I'd lose my job, and it's a Bevan from Redcliffe. I thought, geez, I can't believe I've got this good job in the big city. If I stand up for myself, I might lose my job. So I had many opportunities. In fact, one boss sat down for contract negotiation with me at some stage. Great opportunity. And I stopped him. I said, please, I don't want a pay rise. I feel grateful just to work here. And I feel like
I know you want to kill her, don't you?
I feel like such a fucking idiot now for saying that. But it was that whole good girl thing. And he closed his manila folder.
So tell the room what he said when he closed the manila folder and what he said about the consequence of you turning down the money.
He said, "That's great. Trace, more money in the kitty for the blokes." Terrible.
And I'm just not going to talk to you anymore tonight, I've decided. I actually am quite cross at you about that.
But so many women have, and that's why I wrote the book, are afflicted by the good girl syndrome when it comes to asking for pay rises. And the research bears this out, that from when we're younger, we're brought up not to talk about money. It's the nasty business of talking about money. And there was another contract negotiation earlier in my career when the boss said, I actually did ask for a pay rise early in my career. And he said, "Oh, Trace, you won't need a pay rise. You'll do this job for a couple of years, marry a nice businessman, and then you'll never have to work again." I can see some people in the front. It sounds like it's been said to you too. And this is the kind of stuff that feeds into your psyche. So when you do get ostensibly old enough and comfortable enough to ask for a pay rise, you still think subconsciously, "I don't deserve it."
So we're talking here about the late 80s, early 90s, is that right? Around about the time of this. See, I find that remarkable. I mean, I'd understand if you were telling me these stories from, say, the 1950s or something, but this is relatively recent to be told a story about you'll marry someone who'll take care of you.
Yep. In 1990, I was told to stick my tits out more to give the audience something to look at, even though I'm doing stories on what's happening in Iraq. And look, this is probably jumping to the end of our conversation, but I talk to young journalists these days and a lot of these comments are still being made.
I'm just going to absorb that for a little bit.
Sorry.
Remarkable. Let's not jump ahead. We'll stay where we are. So at what point did this start to become intolerable?
It started to become intolerable when the stick the tits out comment came, which is way back in 1990. But it really became intolerable when I tried to come back from maternity leave with my first child. I had a life-threatening pregnancy complication. I had to spend 5 months on maternity leave instead of the usual TV 2 weeks in commercial television, which is what most people took. It was unpaid, but if you didn't come back, they'd give your job to somebody else. And when I tried to come back, the boss's PA said, "Oh, you better come in. The boss wants to talk to you about something." And I knew what that meant because I'd seen that happen to most of my friends in the industry. There used to be going away parties for women when they went on maternity leave. They weren't going to be coming back. Or if they were came back, they were put on the mummy track. So the lighter stories, not the political or the business stories, not the stories, as John Westacott from Channel 9 used to say, are the stories for your big dicks, your blokes.
Mm. Yeah, they use those phrases, the big swinging dick stories. And what was the other one? The other one that the blokes used to use at The Age had something to do with balls. Of course it did. I can't remember. I've blanked that. Your pregnancy with Taj was incredibly difficult. I just wonder how you managed all that. I mean, you were literally trying to hold on to this pregnancy and trying to hold on to this baby, because I think you had complete placenta previa. So, you know, you were at risk of bleeding and losing this child at any moment. And you kept working for as long as you could, didn't you?
I did. I flew down here to Melbourne. I was based in Sydney and still am. And I started bleeding. I was rushed to the Royal Women's Hospital here. And for a week, it was touch and go. I was 25 and a half weeks. And at the end of that week, I managed to hold on to him. I always think I'm not going to get emotional, and I do. And then the obstetrician said, "Look, you can fly back to Sydney, but you're going to have to spend the rest of your pregnancy flat in your back." So I went up to see the boss in Sydney, told him the situation. He said, "Oh, Trace, you can't be away for that long. The audience will lose a connection with you." And I said, "Well, I'm going to lose a connection with my baby, and I will take this amount of time off." So, and it's interesting when you think about the epiphany, you know, the moment when you finally stand up. Often for women it comes when you're caring for others, not necessarily when you're caring for yourself.
Yeah.
I think it made me stronger knowing that I'm doing this to save my baby's life. And then I went away on the maternity leave and I came back and I was told to come in for the meeting, and I went in for that meeting with a pile of papers this high, state legislation, federal legislation, union regulations, because I knew what was going on. I sat down at the desk and he said, "Oh, Trace, there have been a few changes since you've been away. 5 months is a long time. We want to put some of the younger presenters on the roster." And I said, "Well, what you are saying is illegal and immoral, and I will take you to court." And it sounds really cool now, but my hands were shaking under the table.
I'm sure.
I thought, that's it, it's the end of my career. But you know what? I didn't care. I want to take a stand, not just for me, but for all women.
Mm. And then when you return from your second pregnancy, that's when the shit hit the fan.
Yeah, that's right. I had the TV 2 months off at that time, and they got me back early after my pregnancy with Grace, saying they had a bulletin that needed my gravitas. Read old for that. Fantastic. And I thought, great, mothers are finally welcomed in this workplace. But what they wanted to do was create a sense of separation in time from the end of my maternity leave to when my contract was terminated. So they didn't legally breach the legislation. But in actual fact, they did, and that's why I took action in the federal court.
You know, tell us about that. So let me just set the scene for you for a second. I mean, this is an extraordinary thing for a high-profile presenter to do. This is a... this is a career-risking, career-ending, life-threatening decision to take, to actually take your employer in this most public way to court. They're going to be... The opposition is going to be all over this. It's going to be manna for heaven, from heaven, for, you know, for seven and for nine. They're going to cover this one endlessly, and it's going to forever rupture any connection that Tracy can possibly have with that network. All of this must have been going through your head, but something else must have been stronger. Take us through your thinking.
What was stronger that I wanted to start a national conversation about it to help other women, because I knew that I was in a position of privilege. And Talitha Cummins has said the same thing, the Channel 7 presenter who's recently won a payout after maternity discrimination, that, you know, you see so many women who don't have the financial or emotional means to be able to fight a case like this, and I wanted to fight the case for them, to speak out for them and to make other employers think twice before they dared to do something like this again. To be honest with you, I actually didn't give a shit if it was the end of my career. I just thought, this has gone on for too long. My mum had sadly passed away by that stage, but I wanted to actually do it in her memory and her legacy, because in her generation, women were expected to quit when they got married, let alone have children. And I think that when you look at the history of feminism, it's never linear. There are always peaks and troughs. There's always bursts. And I think it takes action by everybody to take a stand in their own lives to help bring everyone else along with them.
I think what's remarkable also about your story, and in a sense really unremarkable, and you point this out in the book, is that, to generalise from the specific, is that you were then inundated with letters, with emails, with comments from so many other Australians, male and female, all saying the same thing happened to me.
Yeah, the subject line, the emails might have been exactly the same. They echoed each other's stories, and some of the discrimination was explicit. A boss saying, now that you're pregnant, you know, you're not welcome in this workplace anymore. And others were a little bit more subtle. Oh, we thought we'd put you on this easier role, i.e. lower paid, lower profile, lower powered in their workplace. Now that you're pregnant, you'll probably just not want to come back at all or come back
part
time.
And just to jump in there, we're not talking here just about media. These were emails and letters from people, you know, from every walk of life, all echoing Tracy's experience.
And interestingly, and the same thing happened this weekend after an excerpt of my book was published in Fairfax, 60% of them were from men. And they are from men talking about their daughters, their sisters, their mothers, their aunts, and just so appropriate we're talking about this on May Day, May 1, because it's such a huge workplace issue still.
So the legal fight, or the battle, the suit that you filed didn't actually go to court. You settled out of court, and you're in a place in your life where you thought, I just don't, you know, have the strength, the personal strength to sort of take this through. I'll take the money and I'll go. What changed in you after that? What was the most profound change in you?
At the time when I settled, or after that?
At the two times, at that time and then afterwards.
We battled it for about 2.5 months, and there was a huge media campaign of which I was very proud, and we were able to help a lot of women through the union and through my lawyer to be able to fight their own battles. But I had a baby and a toddler, and I was still working because I had to work out the rest of my contract, which was another probably 5 weeks after they got rid of me, and I had to do it by the letter of the law, otherwise my action wouldn't have been effective. Honestly, I ended up having a screaming match on the phone with my lawyer and a barrister where they were saying, look, it's coming up to Christmas. You know, I'd had mastitis 5 times. I was crying at the drop of a hat. I was literally collapsing physically on the floor. I was physically falling apart. And my husband and I still wanted to fight, but they were so kind. They said, look, you can take this to the federal court, but at what cost to your family? And that was where I thought, yes, I can, but my family comes first. So I decided to settle out of court for that reason.
And what changed in you as a woman and as a journalist, as a member of this profession, following that decision and that exit from that part of your life, from that high-profile commercial television world?
I felt like I was forged by fire, to be honest. I highly recommend that anyone takes action, even as terrifying as it might be, because I felt so much stronger after doing it that I could cope with anything. Mm. I didn't feel beholden to the industry anymore. I didn't feel like I had to be the good girl. I felt like I could choose what work I wanted to do, and I was very fortunate in that, although I shouldn't say that. Women always say we're lucky. You don't often hear men say that.
Just so lucky to be here.
I'm so fortunate. The news director at Sky, Angelo Frangopoulos, called up and said, you know, I never thought I'd work in commercial television again. I never thought I'd work at all again, actually. And he called up and said, Trace, we want women like you at Sky. We want strong women. We want parents who can work, you know, both men and women, either job share or flexible hours, around their families. This is the kind of workplace I want to build. And I thought, God, I didn't even know there were workplaces like that out there. So it really was a gift in the respect that it showed me that you can stand up for yourself and it doesn't mean it's the end of the world.
Can we talk about where the women were during all this, the women that you worked with, the colleagues and peers that you have and had? Was there a sisterhood of kinds?
Oh, look, I never like the trope about the vindictive sisterhood or women tearing each other down, because from my experience in society and the workplace, men are just as ambitious as women. Men tear each other down in the workplace just as much as women tear each other down. The media is a competitive workplace. I found personally I got a lot of support privately from men and women in the workplace, but publicly very few people were willing to speak out on my behalf, and I understand that because they're frightened about losing their jobs.
So you really found your voice as a result of that, and then a different kind of Tracy Spicer emerges, and she's the campaigner and the writer and the speaker, and that brings us to the famous TEDx talk. Can you tell us how, well, if you haven't seen it, and we'll talk about that in some detail, can you tell us how we got there? How did we get to this?
At this stage, my daughter's 7 years old, and she comes in when I'm putting on my makeup for Sky one day, and I'm telling you, we trawl it on for television. It's what's expected, the whole beauty myth writ large.
45 minutes in the makeup chair every damn morning.
Yep. And
I'm sorry.
The time and the cost to our self-esteem is horrific. But anyway, my daughter said, Mum, why do women wear makeup and men don't? And I didn't have a good answer for her. I couldn't say it's because it makes us look better, because that makes it sound like we don't look good the way we are naturally. I couldn't say it makes us feel better. That makes it sound like we've got pathologically low self-esteem. So what I said to her was, Grace, it's not right that society expects this of women and not of men. It takes a lot of time. It costs a lot of money, particularly for women working in, you know, very low-paid jobs. A lot of women in retail spend a third of their income on being customer-facing or customer-ready. It's bullshit. It's a cost that's not borne by men. So I said, you know, as you are, you know, going into puberty and going into your teenage years, I don't want to force judgment upon you, but do what you want, but know why you're doing it. Deconstruct it and know why you're doing it.
And then there was an invitation for you to speak at TEDx.
Yeah, there was, and I thought I want to deconstruct the beauty myth and really pitch it particularly at younger women, but also women of my age group who've spent a lifetime putting on the mask and have trouble taking it off because we're accustomed to looking at our faces with makeup on. I thought, how can I do this visually? So I thought I'll get up there in the full newsreader clobber. I was in the makeup chair for 3 hours that day. I had fake tan on and the fake eyelashes and the big hair and, you know, the corporate dress and the big massive high heels, and I'll slowly strip it off, and while doing that I'll explain exactly the time and cost financially and to our self-esteem that it took to look like this. Because a lot of young women look at people on television, at women on television, and think, or in magazines, this is the way that I should look. Why don't I look like that? You know, don't get me started on airbrushing and all of that. Mm. I wanted to break it down to say this is what I really look like.
And so you did, and so you stripped it all off on stage. You must have had a moment before you did all that where you thought, what the hell am I about to do?
I was laughing with Clementine Ford about this last night because she was speaking just before me. She was talking about rape and women's bodies, using the analogy of women's bodies as cars being stolen. And she's amazing at talking and writing about rape culture. And when she said that to me before I got up, I thought, oh, shit, I feel like such a lightweight. I'm just getting up there talking about the beauty myth. And I was so nervous I thought I was going to faint, because You know, with imposter syndrome, and I suffer from panic attacks as well. I thought, this is it. I'm going to go arse up on the TED Talk. This is, again, the end of my career. But I just breathed through it and managed to get it all out and get it all off.
How many views has it had on YouTube by now? What would we be up to?
Well, almost 1.5 million. And I was wondering whether that means that 750,000 people have seen me fully naked, because 1.5 million have seen me half naked.
What I find interesting about it, I mean, apart from the talk itself, which is brilliant, and it's a great bit of performance, and then that brings us back to the more disheartening aspects of it, and we're going to get to that a little bit later with Candy as well. Some of the comments and some of the responses that have been made to it and about it, and mostly by blokes.
Yeah, this is where I got onto the radar of an organisation called the MRA in the United States. It's a men's rights group, and they really have started a war on women internationally. There's a long history of women being silenced all the way back to Homer's Odyssey, Penelope being told that speech is the business of men. Go upstairs and use your loom, Penelope. You should not be in this room. And the modern version is trolling and harassment on social media. Mm. And it was quite an insight, and quite terrifying actually, when the mob piled on after I did my TED talk, and they were threatening to rape and kill not only me but my children, my young children. So I was in Vietnam backpacking when all of this trolling came through. I called a member of the New South Wales Police, who's a friend of mine, and said, geez, I'm terrified about coming back to Australia. What should I do? And he gave me the advice, look, there is legislation against it, but if you take action against these people, it's likely they'll come down harder, which I thought was a bloody terrible response, actually, in retrospect. Yeah. But they were the early days of trolling, and no one really knew how to handle it. So I lived in fear, actually, for months afterwards, because they were publishing my kids' school online. They knew where I lived. It was absolutely terrifying.
Have you got past all that? Is that in the past?
Oh, look, I'm ashamed to admit this tonight, but I'm still, a very feisty, outspoken writer. This is a deliberately provocative book, and I've started getting trolling from the MRA again this afternoon. I haven't had it for about 3 years, because after that TEDx talk incident, I pulled back a little bit from my language in my columns. So the silencing does have effect on writers. Yeah. I've spoken to other writers who've continued going just as hard, Clem and Yasmin among them, and it gets to the point where you think, like I was saying about the kids and taking the federal court action, you can take it so far, but then you think, when is this threatening the health and safety of my family?
You mentioned that you were overseas at the time, and I want to make mention of that in the book as well, because your many trips to developing countries as a journalist clearly are very important to you. How have they changed you as a reporter and also as a feminist?
They're the most important thing in my 30-year career are the 5 or 6 aid trips I've done over the past 25 years. And what they taught me is that gender inequality is a spectrum disorder. And by that, I mean that in Australia, we've talked about the gender pay gap before, that's probably on a scale of 1 to 10, about a 2 or 3. At about 9 or 10 is female foeticide, gendercide in India. Mm. So as women, we all face different challenges, but they're all on a spectrum. And what connects that spectrum is the fact that girls are valued less than boys and women are valued less than men. So when I was in Bangladesh doing stories about the education of girls, or when I was in Kenya doing the story about the HIV epidemic that was predominantly affecting women and children, and girls being fed less than boys, and all the stuff that I did in India as well, the dowry system becoming popular again in India, remarkably, and the growth in female foeticide in India because they can get cheap ultrasound machines from China, so they know they're going to have a girl. It's not a midwife saying you might be having a girl, you probably should abort. It's a doctor saying you are having a girl, you definitely should abort. So these problems keep coming up again and again, and that's what those trips taught me.
And has it changed the way you regard issues of gender inequality here in Australia? Because it's very hard to come back from those places and not, have that instinctive, oh, my God, talk about first world problems.
It did initially. I started sitting around at barbecues with friends and thinking, oh, shut up, talking about, the fact that you need a second fridge, or the fact that your boss isn't giving you a $10 pay rise, shut up. And that's when I realised that it is all linked. And, I actually don't agree with the phrase first world problems anymore, because there is an underlying inequity at the heart of it that we need to talk about. And we need to talk about both types of problems. I learned a lot from my sisters in the developing world, as much as I'm sure that they learnt from me, with a sharing of information and ideas.
Mm. I read this book, Tracy, is the story of a mouthy woman who actually found her true voice. And the lesson for me, I guess, in it, and maybe for all of us, is that the stuff we talk about isn't always the song that we really want to sing.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful. Thank you.
And I wanted to talk to you then about the song that you do want to sing now that you have a platform and you have a voice and you have a face and you have standing. How do you want to use that?
The song I want to sing now is that we need to strip away the good girl or reframe the good girl as the good girl leads the revolution. The good girl fights for her rights. The good girl supports the sisterhood. I do a lot of mentoring and also a lot of training in presentation for television for young women. And I see this good girl. I taught a course 2 weeks ago and they're all frightened to put up their hands. And these are women in their 20s and 30s. And I thought, oh my goodness, we need to talk to each other about the fact that we are still shackled by society's unreasonable expectations. We need to break out of the shackles of the good girl and embrace the nasty woman within. Because I do think this is one of those moments, especially with the anti-Trump movement, where women's rights are forging ahead. There are incredible grassroots movements all around the world. And we need to ride this wave of feminism.
So where's the journalism work for you right now, Tracy? What are you where and what are you working on?
I'm writing regular columns for Fairfax and I'm doing some documentary work as well on issues that I'm passionate about overseas and here, and doing a little bit of stuff for the ABC as well. I love working at the ABC. I must say, after all those years in commercial television, some of my colleagues at the ABC in Sydney say, oh my goodness, did that really happen? Because the ABC is so much better than the rest of the media when it comes to gender inequality. What I want to do for the rest of my life is to raise my voice to help other women in whatever shape that takes.
Tracy Spicer is going to be taking some questions from you in just a moment, but we have a little interlude for you, and this is provided courtesy of the marvellous Candy Bowers, but I'm actually going to let Tracy explain and introduce why we have Candy here this evening. Tracy?
Oh, I'm so excited about this. I met Candy at a Women of Letters speech in Brisbane several years ago, and I was so inspired by the letter that she wrote and how passionate and how intelligent she is about intersectional feminism and this whole third or fourth wave that's happening now. My friend Jenna Price says, stop talking about waves. People will get angry. You know, someone will say it's a third, someone will say it's a fourth. So I spoke to Candy. She's an incredible performance artist. You would have heard of her, I'm sure, about writing a spoken word song containing a lot of the trolling insults that I've received in the past 3 to 4 years and some comebacks and some ways to handle it. So the intention of this song is to stand in solidarity of other women who've been abused, whether we're talking about domestic abuse or sexual harassment or trolled online, and to stand in solidarity and give them a sense of power that, yes, you can stand strong, we are with you, and you can fight back.
And before we introduce Candy, I do have to give you a little bit of a language warning. Because as Tracy said, this is all lifted directly from the abuse that she's copped. And I can tell you, as someone who cops this abuse on a daily basis, all the words are real. Ladies and gentlemen, Candy Bowers.
I listen to this. It really reminds me of Audre Lorde's quote, the quote that's actually allowed me to survive as an artist in Australia, which is, if I didn't define myself for myself, I'd be crunched into other people's fantasies of me and eaten alive. So I think Tracy's been eaten alive in her career. So I guess I wanted to say, ladies and gentlemen, trans folks, non-gender binary lovers, fighters, crips, feminists and friends, this next rhyme is in honour of the trolling Tracy's gone through. It goes out to anyone who's ever been trolled, actually. And once you read the book, you'll get this. But it's titled, I Fart in Your General Direction. Let me paint a picture for you. There's a man, probably heterosexual, cisgendered and white, just going off the stats. He sits alone, probably dealing with a heavy dose of misogyny and seething at a TED talk he's just seen on the internet. Gets his finger ready. First class bitch, feminazi witch, Botox, soapbox, self-centered snitch, wannabe journalist, hypocrite, out of touch, you are fat and your talk is shit. You fucking suck and your fucking shit sag. Fucking unfuckable, nasty fat hag. You wanna talk, but all you do is nag. Like, bitch, 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 cause you're always on your rags. You know this guy? Yeah, it's lovely. Probably got children. Also, I should say, medically, that probably would never happen, sir. Put it out there. You think you're hot, media queen, whining like a twat. Men are so mean, used up, stinky, obscene. You got less in law than a can of sardines. Slut, well, your milk has gone sour. I'll take you out back and pay you by the hour. Oh my God, I'm a genius. I got a tiny brain and an even tinier penis. I just wrote that bit. You probably never wrote that. But a bit of self-reflection would be amazing. What is it? Just one time. Alright, I got something for you. Troll with your small bag of tricks. Why don't you go eat a large bag of dicks? Constant, conceited, conflated fragility, compounded by that toxic masculinity. Drowning in a sea of mad tears. Sexism built on your ego and fears. Women are dangerous, women are toys. Witches and bitches and playthings for boys. Trolleys and dollies painted and poised. Let me get this right. You see, assertive women trigger your hate, let alone those who don't want to lose weight. Oh, and there come the rape threats. Aimed at the kids, that as good as it gets, yeah? As if we all live for that shitful attention. No more a fart in your general direction, what? All right, let's do this. Put your hands up. Everybody, let me see your hands in the air. We're going to do a little bit of strength out there for all the people feeling this right now. Let me hear you say strong.
Strong.
Stay strong.
Strong.
Invincible.
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 Say sisterhood.
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 Now somebody, anybody, everybody, roar!
Yeah! There's a lot of women right now that need to hear that and feel that, so please, don't sit on your hands. Get out there and support them online. Peace.
Candy Bowers, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. Now I get to ask the first question. We're going to roll into question time. And my question is actually about being young, being a young girl. Because I think probably everybody here has a young girl in their lives. I do. My partner has a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old. And there's a lot of things that we worry about, what they're watching on YouTube, what all of that stuff. But how do you feel, I guess, how do you feel as a mother talking about feminism? There's a little bit of it in the book. And I wonder about the kind of tools and things that you use with Grace.
Thank you for that awesome performance and that perfect question, Candy. I just love you. A survey came out by Our Watch a couple of months ago showing that only one in six girls believe they're valued for their brains and their ability. Only one in six. So when I'm talking to Taj and Grace, I've got one child of each gender, we talk about feminism and equality every day. I've got a big, buffy, hairy, farty, very masculine kind of husband, and he talks to them about feminism every day, which is great because it's got to start on the lounge room before it goes into the boardroom. We consume mass media together. We talk about the way women are portrayed and valued for their appearance rather than the boys are the ones who are doing things in books or doing things in movies. The Gina Davis Institute's done tremendous research and action on that, where they found that in crowd scenes in Hollywood movies, only 17% of people are women or girls. And that teaches girls they can only take up a smaller place in society and on the earth. So we break this stuff down for our kids, and if they come up with sexist stuff, which they inevitably do, they bring it home from school and from the mass media, we talk about it, we talk about the history, why people say these things, and we say it's not right. Now, they're fantastic gender warriors in the schoolyard, as I'm sure yours are as well.
There's also something else that you do. We talked about this on News Breakfast this morning, which I really was struck by in the book, and that's whenever your little girl Grace is paid a compliment about the way she looks, you reframe the conversation. Tell us about that.
I do. I segue into something like, well, actually, she's got a great sense of humour, and then Grace tells a fantastic joke. Because it's very hard when you're talking to friends and parents of your kids' friends, you know, and they're saying stuff like, oh, I don't want my boy to be into girls things because I don't want my boy to be effeminate. And, you know, we're so against that kind of stuff because we need boys to be interested in girls movies and girls sport as much as girls are becoming more tomboys and interested in boys things. So we segue to Grace talking more about her ability and her talent and her intellect rather than what she's wearing. If someone says, that's a pretty dress, I'll jump in and say, actually, it's really comfortable. And I've taught her to say that as well. So it's reframing the way we talk about what's pretty and what's not.
Now, we have some microphones in the room and I'm sure we have some eager questioners as well. I think that's going to be managed for me by somebody else. So do we have a first question anywhere? Yes, I think up there. Is that right?
Thank you. As your ticket out of...
Sorry, can I just see your hand so I know where you are? Hello. Thanks.
Hello. Thank you for coming. Your ticket out of Bevanville was education. Could you just explain what your education was? I mean, your university degree and how you got into your first job, please.
Oh, I write about this in the book and I'm so glad that you've highlighted it. I graduated from school at that brief moment in history when Mr. Whitlam gave us free university degrees. Thank you, Gough! Because without that, the area that we grew up in, I was the first person in my nuclear family to go to university, and I think the second in my extended family. There was absolutely no way, even with delayed fees, that I would have been able to go to university, because the research shows that delayed fees are just as bad as fees that are current. Because if you grew up in an area like I grew up in, you do not think that you can even go to university, let alone afford the bloody thing. Mm. Thank you for the question.
And we have a hand up here as well, after this one as well. Yep.
I was just going to ask, given everything that happened to you in your career, do you ever regret choosing TV, or do you tell young girls, you know, develop a thick skin or anything?
I've got four young women who I mentor through a group that I'm the national convener of called Women in Media, and I say to them, do take up TV as a career because we need to change the system from within. And it is tough, and I warn them about, that's what this book is about. I want this book to be read by, you know, say a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old who lives in Broadmeadows who doesn't really understand, you know, feminism or structural discrimination in the workplace, to warn them about what they might face and to give them strategies for challenging that. If we don't have, you know, strong women and girls still going into our industry, then the sexist structures and the misogyny has won. We need to keep fighting the good fight.
There's a hand there. We've got a hand up the front here as well. I'm going to get one here. And then there's one just there.
Thank you so much to the Wheeler Centre again for a fantastic discussion, and you ladies, it was absolutely fantastic. Can you just confirm that you aren't related to Sean Spicer?
Why? Would you disbelieve everything she said if she was?
I'm sure it's not so. Look, speaking of sexism at the top of organisations, put your news cap on. Recently, Saudi Arabia has been appointed to the UN Commission on the Status of Women, a body dedicated to the promotion of gender equality and the empowerment of women, if you could comment on that. And this week, the president of Austria, Alexander von Bellum, speaking in German, said something that was translated as follows. One day, the day will come when we will have to ask all women to wear a headscarf. All out of solidarity to those who do it for religious reasons. Could you comment on those two world events?
I get a lot of people asking me to comment on race and culture when it comes to feminism, and that's at the heart of intersectional feminism. A lot of women face different challenges in different countries dependent upon their race, their culture, their level of physical ability. What I would say to that is, it's all on the spectrum. We all face similar challenges. And the commonality is not religion, it is not race, it is not culture, it is sexism and misogyny. So whatever country we're talking about, whether it's Australia or Saudi Arabia, and certainly there are vastly different challenges, at the heart of it is inequality between men and women. Thank you.
Thank you. I was always one of those good girls at work, and I just, this is particularly for Virginia, when I would be confronted by men telling me that I was wrong because I was a woman, I used to think to myself, what would Virginia Trioli do in this moment? And that, just by thinking, that would keep my anger down. And the other thing I used to think of was when Penny Wong said to George Brandis, are you going to be belligerent all day or just for this moment? And I think using some of those role models that are public make a big difference. So you do make a difference to women in very small businesses all the time.
Well, that's very nice to hear. Thank you very much. Can I know the microphone has left you, but can I just ask you, were you seriously told that you were wrong because you were a woman? Was that the actual statement, really?
Oh, on a number of occasions.
Good God.
I come from a retail background working in menswear for 30-odd
right.
years.
Uh-huh.
I've been asked, what would I look like in my underwear?
Mm. Yep.
I've been told, we don't actually know how to do the maternity leave policy. If you just tell me, we'll do it.
Mm. I hope you came up with a good one.
Yeah.
Oh, it's 10 months paid leave.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think the classic was when I was questioned what I would know about driving through the city. And at the time, I used to live in South Bank and I used to drive to Collingwood.
Yes.
And we were talking about moving merchandise through the city. And I was asked, what would I know?
Look,
That's a very short time ago.
I get that. Look, thank you for the comment that you make. It's funny when you say you reflect on what would Virginia Trioli do, because I think she'd do something very, very different now. And it probably wouldn't help me. But it's interesting, Tracy, how your fuse gets shorter and your tolerance for bullshit just sort of totally, it evaporates, doesn't it, as life goes on now. I don't necessarily advocate that as a strategy for the world. You still need to sort of somehow rub along to get along. You know, we're a lot of people in a messy, complex, angry world, and we somehow need to get along with each other, gendered or not. So I'm going to take your comment tonight as a reminder to me to sort of to win hearts and minds along the way and not just tell people they're dickheads.
Although we do love that about you as well.
Now, I hope we have another question. I think we do, just here. Hello.
That's a really good jumping off point from what I want to ask. I'm a woman in my early 30s. I'm bathed in privilege. I'm white. I'm straight. I'm married.
Oh, get out of here.
And thinking about starting a family, and I take my wedding ring off when I go to job interviews. I've been part of the enterprise bargaining agreement at work, and I'm only one of two people left on a committee of 12. I feel like I have a target on my back. How much do I rub against the system? How much do I work with it? Can you only make that change when you're short, when your fuse gets short after you're protected?
It's such a terrific area to talk about, because I've actually asked the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, the former one, Liz Broderick, about this. I said, can you tell me categorically that when I'm advising young women to take action that they won't have a black mark against their name? And she said, categorically, I cannot tell you that. If you stand up and fight, there will be some blowback. There's no doubt about that. But please take this on board for your situation. It is something that you will never regret afterwards. If something does happen there, you will find another job somewhere else that values you for who you are, that values your family, that values you as a working woman. You know, it's terrible that we still have to have these conversations, but that is the most honest answer that I can give you.
I think what I'd say to that, and I had similar moments in my early 30s, even at the ABC, and I remember when I came back from my wedding and my then boss said to me, we're talking about the ABC here, my then boss said to me, oh, are you going to go and get pregnant as well now like every other woman on this bloody floor? You know, because you're kind of the only one left. And I think I remember a small voice blurting out of me sort of saying, no! What would Virginia Trioli do? She would collapse like a sack of spuds. But, you know, not to be a sellout to the crash through or crash approach, which, you know, I advocate as well, there's a part of me that thinks if you are confronted by a system that is so appalling, you know, that is so unsupportive and is so unfair, lie your head off. Lie your head off. Tell them what they want to hear, you know. Bullshit them and get what you want. I think the most important thing that I always tell young women is you have to find a still, quiet place at some point in your life and try and answer that question that we all have to answer. What do I really want? What do I really want? What am I here for? What's my life going to be about? And it's very interesting what your internal voice throws up. It's sometimes not what you were expecting. And then you go after that. And you use all fair means that you can to achieve that, because that's you singing your song. And if that means, you know, you take your wedding ring off and then when you're in there, you know, act like your true self, well, you know, so be it. It's not the most elegant solution. It's not the most truthful solution. But I kind of feel like you're almost coerced into doing that when you're confronted with such an unfair system. I don't know, look, there might be women in the room who might disagree with me on that, but there's a little part of me that gets so irritated by that that I think, well, that's one way of fight. There are two ways of fighting back. And I think, you know, Tracy and I sort of represent both of them here this evening. So pick the one that works for you. We're almost coming up on time here, but I think we do have one or two questions. Yes, we're just about to get a microphone to someone. Here we go. Hi.
Hi there. I work in a community with predominantly elderly people and women, and I'm just wondering, from someone who's, I guess in your industry, been seen as, what did you use the word before, seen as maybe an older woman now? I'm a younger woman in leadership working with predominantly older women mm-hmm. who maybe have lived through that point where they were asked to go home and be with the kids, and that's their worldview. What one-liners or sound bites could you give us that would help to educate our parents and grandparents that the world has changed rapidly for us, and that they might be able to support us rather than tell us that's not how it should be?
So you're talking about older women in the workplace who are saying, oh, you should be at home with your children.
Why don't you get married and have a child?
Oh, yes, that kind of stuff. Look, I'm a big fan of storytelling and shaming for influencing opinion, but it needs to be based upon data. And in my book, I have some research, because there was this real scare campaign around the time that John Howard was Prime Minister, and Anne Summers wrote about this in her book at the time. All of this bodgy research showing that children are damaged by childcare or by not being with their mother. And it has been roundly disproven in the subsequent decades, but women in that era, and men in that era, a lot of them, still hang on to those old tropes. So say to them, the research has proven that good childcare is actually better for children when it comes to learning and socialisation. That it's actually good for fathers to be hands-on with their children as well as mothers, or two primary carers or one primary carer. But, you know, and even statistics on the workplace, you know, it's better for society, it's better for participation if they're the kind of, oh, look, it depends on whether they're economic rationalists or not. You know, it's better for the country all round if men become more hands-on with caring and there are more women in the workplace. It's win-win. So you can use a bit of statistic and a bit of storytelling around that.
We could tell them it's my life and I'll live it how I want.
Why? And that's people, a good comeback too.
Why are people always trying to make us live someone else's life?
Well, that's it, and they can make their own choices and you can make your own choice.
I think that actually is, for me, has sort of been, you know, the key lesson of getting older is, and it's so obvious, it's the nose on your face, isn't it? But it's remarkable how we take so long to get to the obvious that you only get one shot at this. You know, we're more than halfway through it. You've got to live it authentically. You've got to live it truthfully. And if you're not living it the way you want to do it right now, walk out the door this evening and make the change that you need to make in order to live it. And if they're trying to make you live some other life, you just push back against that.
What's wonderful about your generation, just briefly, is that the scales have fallen from your eyes. You see this inequality, whereas a lot of people from our generation were surrounded by this wallpaper of misogyny. It's there everywhere. You become accustomed to it and you just can't see clearly anymore that it is misogyny.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tracy Spicer will be signing books, and you will be buying books later on. This is why you are here. But before we do that, we're going to give her an enormous ovation and a great round of applause. Tracy Spicer!
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.